iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Ruthie's Table 4 in partnership with Montclair. Across the garden from where Surgeon General Vivek Muthi and I are sitting, people are having Sunday lunch in the River Cafe. Walking into the room, you hear the rise and fall of conversation and laughter, friends and families connecting over food. At age 37, Vivek was appointed as the youngest Surgeon General of the United States by President Obama and is now serving a second term with President Biden. During COVID, in his gap between terms as Surgeon General, he might have researched illnesses, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, but instead he chose what he saw as another epidemic of our time, loneliness. His book, Together, The Healing Power of Human Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World, tackles loneliness as a condition seriously detrimental to the health of millions of people. He is a Surgeon General who sees love as a foundation of policy making. How rare to hear the word love as a solution to a diagnosis. He says food is an antidote to loneliness, believing loneliness is like hunger and like thirst. I am privileged today to talk with and listen to the Surgeon General and to hear how, as a doctor, a father, a husband, a child, and now my friend, food is a connection, and food is love.
Yeah.
I mean, it is also why you're here, isn't it? Are you doing a conference? So it is a global concern now.
And it's actually why I find that this work around food to be so powerful, because I think that, you know, people like you, Ruthie, who have been so deeply immersed in not just the preparation of food, but food as a cultural force, I think have long recognized that food has the power to bring us together, to put us in a place of ease where we can be more open and talk to one another, which is why I think people like breaking bread with one another, and conversation happens differently over food than it does in a conference room. But I think that food is also, at its best, you know, a force for love. And I feel that fundamentally, the question that's before us in society, not just in the U.S., but all over the world, is do we want to be a society that's driven by fear? And with all that comes with that, anger, anxiety, insecurity. Or do we want to be a society that's fueled by love and by all that comes with that, compassion and kindness and generosity and looking out for one another? And so that's ultimately what I hope that we can build together, is a world fueled and powered by love. And I think that's a world where we can build extraordinary things, where we can bring benefits to everyone, where we can overcome adversity no matter what comes, and where we feel a sense of optimism and hope. It worries me greatly that as I travel that so many people feel pessimistic and anxious. But I also think that what gives us hope during hardship is our connection to one another. And so that's what I want us to rebuild, you know, in our lives. We have it within us. I think this is actually our true nature. It's a question of giving voice to it and coming together around that kind of society. And I think we can build it.
We will.
Yeah.
We will. Thank you. So what we'd like to do is to read a recipe, and you chose the recipe of pumpkin soup.
Yes.
So would you like to read that recipe? And you can read it any way you like.
Sure. So this is a recipe for pumpkin soup. And I chose pumpkin soup in part because I, having grown up in Miami, Florida, where it's very warm, and then having subsequently moved to very cold weather places, I was always craving warmth, and soup was the easiest way for me to find that. And I love pumpkins, in part because I love Halloween. So pumpkin soup. 3 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, 50 grams of butter, 2 cloves, sliced garlic, 20 sage leaves, a 2-kilogram pumpkin, peeled, seeded, cut into large cubes, 1 potato, peeled and cubed, 1 red chili, 1 liter of chicken stock, 2 tablespoons of grated Parmesan, and 1 tablespoon of creme fraiche. Heat the olive oil and butter, add garlic and sage, and fry for 5 minutes. Add the pumpkin and potato. Fry for 1 minute before adding chili seasoning, and season well with salt and pepper. Pour enough stock to cover the pumpkin and bring to a boil. Reduce the heat and simmer for 20 minutes until the pumpkin is tender. Strain half of the stock from the pumpkin into a bowl and set aside, pouring what is left into a food processor. Pulse until the mixture is very thick. Return the mixture to the pan and add strained stock and stir. Serve with Parmesan and a drizzle of olive oil and creme fraiche on top.
Is this something you can imagine eating and cooking?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I found myself getting hungry even though I had a whole meal after reading this recipe. So this is wonderful. Yeah. Yes.
So if we begin at the beginning, this is going to be a long, nice conversation about life and work and loneliness and happiness, food. Tell me about your family. Are they from India? Came to London? Or to England?
Yeah, my family is originally from India. My mother is from Bangalore, a city in the south of India. And my father is from a small farming village about 2 hours outside of Bangalore. And they grew up in fairly modest households. My mother's family was, middle class. My father, though, came from a poor farming community, and his family did not have much at all in the way of resources growing up. After they got married, they moved to England, and they lived here for 7 years in London for some part of that time. And then in other parts, they lived in Leeds. They lived in up north in Huddersfield, which is actually where I was born and where my sister was born. They lived in Wales, Scotland, and then ultimately moved to Canada and then eventually to the U.S.
Did they bring the food of India with them? Do you think that?
They've never left the cuisine they grew up with behind. And they not only cooked and sought out that cuisine when they were in England, but even growing up, the aromas that I remember as a child are of the Indian food that my parents cooked at home.
What was it like? What the dishes that you remember?
They had very different styles of cooking. So my mother was a primary cook, but my father cooked often, and he brought great joy to cooking. So my mother, the hallmark of her food was simple but rich flavors.
Yeah.
So she would only cook with a few ingredients, but she would somehow make all of them sing. And people from the community would often come and ask her, "How did you make that? I have the list of ingredients, but somehow I can't get quite the same flavor out of it." And she would always say to me that one of her secrets was her intention when she cooked. She said she would think of the love that she wanted to, the food to represent, and the love she wanted to give to the person who enjoyed the food, and she would bring that into her mind and pour it into the food.
It's one of her ingredients.
Yes, love was one of her ingredients.
Yeah.
And my father was an incredibly creative cook. If my mother's hallmark was simplicity, his was complexity. So he had often many ingredients. And if you ask my father, "How did you make that dish? Because it was so good," he'll have a hard time telling you because he doesn't quite remember the proportions and this. He doesn't measure. He just adds based on his instinct. He's a creative cook, but an equally talented one.
Would he cook on special occasions, or would he just cook every day?
When we were growing up, he would cook on special occasions because he was working often.
What was his job?
He was a doctor, and he initially worked in emergency rooms and in hospitals, then eventually set up his own clinic, in Miami in 1985, which he continues to work in until this day. Now alongside my sister, who's also a primary care doctor.
Three doctors in the family. Only three? Is it more than three?
Three of us, three of us in the nuclear family. So we say my mother is essentially close to a doctor herself because she actually ran the medical practice that my father worked in. She managed the whole operation. And because it was a small shop, it was just the two of them seeing patients. A lot of times the patients would come and talk to her about what they were going through. And over time, she came to sort of recognize various symptoms and be able to make diagnoses on the side. So it was very interesting. But
And when you went to Miami, did you live within a very Indian community, or was it?
When we first got there, we didn't know many people who were Indian. The Indian community was still small. And over time, as the Indian community grew, that became an important part of our experience. But initially, it wasn't the case. And I think that's part of the reason why I felt quite different as a young person growing up. I didn't know a lot of people in those early years who ate the food that we ate or had the customs that we had or had names that sounded like ours. And I often felt like an outsider. And it's funny, I know how these early experiences stick with you. And I still remember that feeling of what it felt like to be an outsider and to not feel like you belong. And it's why I have found that in years since, I'm particularly sensitive to when other people feel like they're outsiders, because I felt that and it doesn't feel good. So,
did your sister experience that as well?
She did.
Yeah,
she did.
And your parents. Did your grandparents come with you at all? Did they?
I wish they had.
Yeah.
They did not. They stayed in India, and I miss them a lot, because when we were young, during holidays, during Christmas and Thanksgiving, people would go away and spend time with extended family. They would come back with these wonderful stories about their grandparents and about how grandma gave them this or grandpa took them here. And I often wish that our grandparents were closer, but they came to visit a few times when we were younger, and I really treasured those times.
Would they cook?
Yes. Well, my grandmother would cook, my mother's mother, and my father's mother had unfortunately passed away when he was young, when he was 10. But his father would actually cook as well, because he had been used to cooking for himself. And they all had their own styles, but the one thing that was common among all of them is there was a lot of joy when they were in the kitchen. They were cooking from a place of happiness. They knew they were going to be bringing happiness to people with the food. It wasn't functional. It wasn't,
Gotta get the meal on the table. Yeah, get the food out.
That's right. There's some real joy.
Do you think that is specific to Indian cooking, that is more of a group activity, or do you think?
It's a good question. I think other cuisines, other cultures have that as well. Yeah. But I do worry that in modern living, that we've gotten away from a lot of that, and that food preparation has become more functional than nurturing and therapeutic. And that old community style of sitting together and both making the food and consuming the food, I think some of that got lost, perhaps just as life structures change and in the interest of efficiency, or we can just get food delivered, or we can pop something in the microwave. And it does feel like it saves time. But I think perhaps what may not have been as deeply appreciated was how much was lost in terms of the community that's built, the relaxation also that comes when you're working with your hands and creating something beautiful in the form of food that others will enjoy. Mm.
People often say to me, how can you cook for 150 people in the restaurant when it's hard to give a dinner party at home for 12 people? And I go, I can't do a dinner party for 12 people at home. It's so much easier doing it in a restaurant because you're collaborating. You know, you have, you're cooking. It is that thing of cooking with other people, sharing a conversation, tasting each other's food, talking about what you're going to do. And that community of working in a restaurant is so nice. You know, I do, of course, cook for 12 people at home, but it can be very solitary just being in the kitchen by yourself.
It can be, yeah. And that's where I think doing it together, whether it's as family, as friends, really makes a difference. Some of my best memories growing up were actually of all of us, my sister and I, along with my parents, actually cooking together. Mm-hmm. So when we would have guests over, it was stressful at times because we got to get everything ready for the guests in time, et cetera. But the fun part was that we made things together. So one of my jobs was to make the list of items that we were going to cook that day.
Was that for shopping? Kind of going to shop?
But actually for cooking also, like the dishes that we were going to make.
Yeah.
And then I would be, you know, a sous chef for my mom. And then she would help put things together. I would chop. I would, you know, mix things together. I would watch things on the stove and roast vegetables or other ingredients. And when they were done, it was my job to check it off on the list. And I had to ultimately make sure that everything was checked off before the guests came. So
good preparation for future life, maybe.
To this day, when I go home, if we're going to have people over, my mother she'll turn to me and say, make the list.
Make the list.
And so I make the list.
It's interesting what you said also about your grandparents, because people that we've talked to on the podcast, very often, especially if they've come from another country, from Ghana to London or from China to London, from wherever they've traveled, they very often talk about their grandparents almost more than their parents, because sometimes the mother adapts, you know, the mother adapts her cooking. The child only sometimes wants to eat the food of the culture he's moved to. But the grandmother clings to more to what, you know, or the grandfather, I should say, from their country. Did your mother adapt, or did she only cook Indian food? Did she ever make you hamburgers or meatballs and spaghetti, or was all the food of your home the food of India?
Yeah, you know, my mother still to this day primarily cooks Indian food, like, and almost exclusively, I would say. So that is what we ate growing up. My father, on the other hand, has, he still makes a lot of traditional Indian food, but he does a lot of creative fusion food. Mm-hmm. So he has an Indian version of spaghetti that he makes and of other pastas. Well, I don't know what he calls it. It doesn't actually have a name, but when you eat it, you taste all of these flavorful Indian spices. And then he does other interesting things too. Like, he'll take jackfruit, which is, I'm not sure if you've had it or not, but it's a fruit that grows in the tropics when it's ripe. It's yellow and rubbery and very sweet. But in its raw form, it can actually be used for savory dishes, and it's quite tender. It can actually mimic a steak. So he'll chop up, you know, raw jackfruit, and then he'll drop it into the pasta. And so it almost tastes like you're eating meat in the pasta, but it's all vegetables. So he'll do all of these crazy creative things.
How to meet your dad. Both of them sound like great cooks.
They are.
How did they work all day and then come home and make... Did you sit with your sister every night around the table and your parents after a long day at school?
We did. And the reason we did that was actually because my parents were insistent that we always have dinner together every night. Yeah. Sometimes my sister and I, as kids growing up, we'd get annoyed. You know, we'd say, well, you know, our friends get to like sit in front of the TV during dinner time. Why can't we do that? Or, you know, why don't you guys have dinner? We're busy doing something, you know, we're reading this book. We'll have dinner later. But they were always insistent that we have to eat together. So much so that when I was in high school, Ruthie, and when we, you know, sometimes we had a lot of homework and like I was in the middle of like writing an essay and I didn't want to stop exactly when dinner time was. And they would just wait for us. And I still feel guilty and somewhat embarrassed to say this, but like, I still remember many nights in high school where I was like stressed about an exam and I was late studying and I didn't feel like a quiet break. And they would stay up and just wait until, and we would eat at 9 or 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night, but they would just wait because they wanted to have dinner together. I still can't believe I made them wait that long.
They probably didn't mind. You know, I think I can imagine waiting for my children to finish. I think, you know, they're probably so, but it's your sister as well, would you study?
Yeah. And we were in the same grade growing up, so we thankfully had a lot of the same assignments and everything. So,
Did you go to friends' homes for dinner? Did you go to other people's houses for dinner?
We did, yes. Yeah. We went to other people's homes, and that was always a real source of joy because it was always a family affair, and it was always very informal. So it wasn't that there was a big long table and everyone would sit together around that table. Usually, there was food that was made. People would often bring food almost potluck style. All the dishes would be laid out on a table and everyone would just noisily, messily grab a plate, you know, put food on it and then go to various parts of the house in small groups and this and that. And as kids, we would, you know, we would just all hang out in a room together and eat and play. And it was fun. I really enjoyed it. It was community. It was food. It was entertainment.
Very evocative, very beautiful description of this life at home. Was that a big break then when you went off to university, when you went to Harvard? Was that a shock to the system that suddenly you were away from that?
It was a shock. It was actually extremely hard for me. And I struggled a lot, especially during my first semester away. I felt really lonely. I felt just really disconnected. And being a shy, introverted, kid, I had a hard time just making friends off the bat. You know, it took me a while to get to know people. And so that was, it was very hard. I remember coming home at the for the first time after enrolling in college during Christmas break. And I had my suitcase in my hand. The door opened. I stepped in. I put my bags down. I looked up at the ceiling of the house in which I had grown up, took a deep breath, and I said to my father, I feel like I've just been released from prison. And I had almost forgotten that I had said that until a few years ago he reminded me, and it brought back this like flood of emotions of what it had felt like to be just separated from this love that had nurtured me for so long. And things got a bit better after that as I was able to make friends and build a community. But some years after, when I was in my residency training, in my first year, when I was working, you know, probably 80, 90, 100 hours a week, but seeing and working with patients who were going through some of the most difficult moments of their life, including people who are my age, you know, at that time, young people in their 20s who were dealing with metastatic cancer and only had a few months to live, I started reflecting then and thought to myself, I never want to lose my connection to my family. I want to make sure that every time, moment that I have, that I'm spending it with family and friends, you know, whether that's vacation time, weekend time, I was like, I want to make that a priority. So after that, I started going home much more often to see my parents and to spend time with them, even if it was just for a weekend, you know, it was worth it because I always remember those patients I cared for, those young patients. And it just reminds me that we all don't know how much time we have. And I want to make sure I'm spending that time with the people, the time I have with the people that I love.
Did you know the River Cafe has a shop? It's full of our favorite foods and designs. We have cookbooks, linen napkins, kitchenware, tote bags with our signatures, glasses from Venice, chocolates from Turin. You can find us right next door to the River Cafe in London or online at shoptherivercafe.co.uk.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s.
She looked like a million bucks.
With zero qualifications.
She had a Harvard plaque.
Tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion that this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million.
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When you were growing up, you describe always eating at home and cooking at home and the community of home. But would you go to restaurants in Miami? Would that be a...
We would from time to time.
It's interesting. Do you
remember them? I do. I remember that my parents, because they liked spicy food in particular, and some stories I can tell you about spice and my father and the crazy...
He made some special hot sauce, did he?
Yes, he makes a series of different hot sauces from different types of peppers, including some are from habanero peppers, some are from special Jamaican hot peppers, some are from ghost peppers. He's like extremely spicy sauce, so much so that when he makes them, we all have to leave the house.
The house?
When he makes the sauce.
Not even the kitchen or
the... No, the house. We have to step outside because, and he wears something that's equivalent to a gas mask when he makes it because the fumes are so incredibly overpowering, but... Once he's made it and put it in a bottle, if you add a little bit to your food, it tastes incredible as long as you can tolerate the spice. So, but, you know, and I generally, like I eat a lot of spice, but that level of spice is even hard for me to tolerate.
So would he find a restaurant that could serve him the equivalent?
So we would always be on the lookout for them. And so I remember many times going to Chinese restaurants, for example, and he would ask them, like, can you make it spicy? And there was always a cadence to this conversation. First question, can you make it spicy? They would say yes. Second question, how spicy can you make it? And they would say, well, we have a 5-star scale, and we can make it 1 to 5. Then the third question would say, can you make seven six. Stars?
Right? Like, can you do? I was gonna guess six.
And then they would get scared because they didn't want something to happen against you. But then he would go through trying to convince them that he really could take the spice. So generally when we went out to eat, it was often in restaurants where they hope people could make the food spicy. Chinese restaurants, Thai restaurants, food cuisines of that sort.
Yeah. And when you were in university, what was the food like there? Was that a shock as well, just sitting down to the kind of food they serve at school? Or did you go out?
It was. I actually lost a lot of weight in college. Yeah. I think I'm a fairly normal weight now. But I actually, if you can picture this, I weighed 40 pounds less when I was in college.
Did anybody notice? I mean, did anybody notice that there was a student in his freshman year homesick and losing weight and lonely, do you think? Was there any...
One's ever asked me that question. Outside of my family, I don't think anyone noticed, and... it was painful to my family. Yeah. See, they clearly knew something was wrong. I wasn't feeling happy, etc. What I used to do is, because I missed the food of home also, is I had a little packet of spicy powder that I would take with me to the dining hall. And I would sprinkle it on everything, anything and everything I could find. I would just like spice it up. And so even people who didn't know me knew that I was a kid with the spicy powder.
I have a friend who travels with chilies. She always travels with some chili that she can put on food. I don't know whether she's afraid of having inconsequential food or whether she just loves it with spicy, but she always travels.
Well, I learned that actually from my parents, because when we would go out to restaurants that couldn't make food spicy, sometimes they'd be really disappointed. So they would always have their own powder that they would add to it. I remember a few times going out. At that time, as kids, we loved pizza and we wanted to eat pizza, and we didn't make pizza at home, but we always wanted to go to Pizza Hut or something. So sometimes they'd begrudgingly go, and they would dutifully bring the spicy powder and sprinkle it all over the pizza so that it looked like red pizza,
You were in Harvard and Boston and Cambridge. Did you have lobsters, or did you try the local food from the Cape?
I had some of the local food, some of the Italian food I had in the North End.
Was that a revelation, or had you had it in Miami?
It was much better in the North End. I think the limited pasta I had in Miami was... it wasn't as authentic, as what the North End's was. So that was quite extraordinary. And then the pastries also, like the Italian pastries, were just incredible. I had never had anything like that before.
I don't know Indian desserts. Are they quite yogurt-based? Am I saying the right thing?
So some of them are dairy-based. And a lot of them are not. The Indian sweets tend to be quite rich, and also quite sweet as well, which is why some people love them, some people really don't like them.
Do you like them?
I do. I mean, look, I have like 32 sweet teeth, so I have I just love desserts, which is part of the reason I try to eat them very sparingly, because otherwise I would just eat dessert all day long. But I used to, when I was growing up, I learned to make one of the sweets in particular that, became. So it was, it goes by different names, but in our family, we called it Kesari Bhat. Mm-hmm. And it's also called Shira in other parts of India. But it's my mom's type of dessert. It's very simple in terms of the ingredients. It involves, basically what you do is you take a pan, you put, let's say, 2 cups of cream of wheat, or something equivalent to that. You roast that with some clarified butter or ghee, and you put some raisins in there to roast as well. So you're roasting that for a while until you start to smell like the wheat, sort of aroma come to your nose. And once it's slightly browned, then what you do is that you actually add a couple things. You can start by adding a little bit of sugar, right? About a quarter cup or half cup of sugar you'll start to see glisten in the sugar melt. And then what I used to do is I would actually slice bananas and add them to that as well. And then you crush cardamom, with the mortar pestle, and then you sprinkle the cardamom on top. And then you mix it all together, and then you let the water evaporate until you have something that's very silky smooth. And you just, the combination of the sugar, the fruit, and the cardamom just really brings the dessert to life. So I used to make that, when
Do
I was
you still
growing
make
up.
It?
In fact, I just made it a couple of weeks ago for my kids.
It seemed very recent, almost, the way you were describing it. Or is it something that's just always stayed in your memory?
It's always stayed in my head. Like, I made it 2 weeks ago for the first time in probably 10 years. Huh. And it brought back all these wonderful memories. Yeah.
Do you cook at home now?
Now, very little, which I regret. I used to cook a fair amount up until I finished my medical training, and then it just sort of fell off. I
Did you, when you were doing your medical education, did you have a family then, or were you?
I did just, not. No.
So put everything into your studies.
And, yeah, I got married later in life when I was 38 years old. Mm-hmm. In fact, I got married and then have now I have two wonderful kids. Yeah. But in those days, I was a bachelor doing my own thing in the kitchen.
What did you study in medicine? What was your specialty?
So I ended up studying internal medicine, which is the care of adults, and I ended up specializing in hospital-based medicine. So when people were admitted to them, if they're sick enough to be admitted to the hospital, then I was the doctor who would take care of them there. Mm. So that's the
And the hours are grueling, no? Would you be working?
They were long hours.
Again, I'm thinking about how you would eat. Did you manage to cook? You said you did cook when you were at school.
I did cook, yeah. But it wasn't, I mean, I had to like cook a bunch of food and then like eat it over several days because there wasn't, sometimes you would come home at 3 a.m. and then you'd have to leave 2 hours later, 5 a.m, to go and start the next day's round. So there wasn't a lot of time to cook. So I would try to cook in advance, you know, and have some food. But sometimes it wasn't easy. And so I ended up having to eat out or eat in the hospital cafeteria a lot, which was,
We could talk about hospital food, couldn't we? Because that is such an issue now. The way we feed our children and the way we feed sick people in our society, I think, tells us about how we care for people.
No, I think that's very astutely said, and I think you're right. I think one thing, if you look at the list of medicines that we prescribe, there's one thing that's missing from that list, and it's food, right? Because food is medicine, and food helps us heal in many direct and indirect ways. Yet somehow it does feel that the food we give people in hospitals and the food that we even give kids in school, I think about the cafeteria, you know, in my school growing up and like what we used to eat. And it's not the kind of, I think, food we would want to give children and give people who are ill if we fully understood just how powerful food is in healing and how vital it is for our well-being and sustenance. And I do worry that what has happened in part over the years is that we've allowed, and I'm, you know, my primary experience is with the United States, but I do think, sadly, this is happening in many other parts of the modernized world. I do think we've allowed our food supply to become poisoned, in a sense, by foods that are overly processed and that are filled with excessive amounts of salt and sugar. And we've gotten away from, I think, some of the healthier food that we all need. And it starts really early. You know, I think if children had the opportunity to experience healthy food, I think it would make a big difference. And I do believe just from a moral perspective, that no child should ever have to go hungry. No child should ever have to eat food that is bad for them just to survive. Yet that is a reality that so many families are living right now. And I do think it comes from just a failure from a policy perspective to understand the vital importance of healthy food in raising our children and making sure that society is healthy and whole.
Mm. That is interesting to think of how that happened and when that happened, you know, the path to not being concerned about feeding our children.
I think that the paradox is that we've somehow made unhealthy food cheap and made healthy food expensive, which has put health out of the reach of so many people in society. And that is what we have to flip, because if we don't do that, then I worry that this rise in chronic illness that we're seeing, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, significant amount of which is driven by diet, that we'll see those trends continue unless we manage to get back to the root of what's driving it, which is in large part our diet.
Yeah. And so you're going from to describing being the person that people met in hospital and working with patients. And how did that segue from that until, how'd you become a Surgeon General? You know, for people who are listening who might not know where the two words Surgeon General comes from, can you tell us?
Absolutely. Well, in the United States, the position of Surgeon General is designated to be an individual who's sometimes informally called the nation's doctor, but whose responsibility is twofold. And one is to make sure that the public has the best possible information about health so that they can make good decisions for themselves and their families. And the second is to oversee one of our 8 uniformed services in the U.S. government, which is called a U.S. Public Health Service Commission Corps. People are familiar with the Army, the Navy, the Air Force. Well, one of our services is the Public Health Service as well. And we focus entirely on protecting the health of people, not just in the United States, but also extending that mission outside the U.S. as well. So those are the responsibilities I have as Surgeon General.
And how did you go from being a doctor in a hospital to being the Surgeon General?
Well, you know, I don't entirely know, okay. To be honest with you, and I'll tell you how it happened, but after I finished my medical training, I was teaching at a hospital. I was practicing medicine and caring for patients. I was doing that for a good chunk of my time. And then on the side, I was actually building a technology company that I hoped would help to accelerate medical research to help bring treatments and cures to people more effectively. And I was had gotten involved probably in 2007, 2008, I think around that time frame, also in health policy work. So I was doing that hodgepodge of things like that, you know, at the time, but never actually thought of working in government. But then one day I happened to be, you know, actually picking up my dry cleaning that day from the dry cleaners, and my hands were full and my phone rang. And it was a 202 area code, which is the Washington, D.C. Yes. I lived in Boston at the time and I didn't recognize the number, so I didn't pick it up. But then finally I decided, let me just take the number. And that happened to be a call from the White House at that time asking if I'd be interested in being considered for this position. And what I came to understand later is that the President Obama and his team were looking to modernize the office of the Surgeon General. They recognized this was a new age that we were coming into where people received their information differently. They learned about health issues differently. And there's a whole new dimension of health threats that we were facing, including the opioid epidemic and the fentanyl crisis. So anyway, they seemed to think that I might be a good fit for that role. So they reached out at that time, and that's how the whole journey began.
If you like listening to Ruthie's Table 4, would you please make sure to rate and review the podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...with zero qualifications...
She had a Harvard plaque.
...tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion. ...that this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million?
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When you had that break between being Surgeon General with President Obama and then now your position with President Biden, tell me, what did you do and how did that lead to your interest in loneliness?
Well, to be honest with you, Ruthie, I was quite lost in the beginning. And I, you know, I was coming off of serving as Surgeon General for about 2.5 years or so. And my identity had become wrapped up in that role. And I was abruptly a civilian again and trying to figure out a bunch of questions. And one of the things I was struggling with in the process was that I had really lost any sense of community during those few years that I served in government. I had largely, you know, I sort of told myself, I think, a familiar story that many people tell themselves, perhaps when they have jobs for a short period of time, which is, I got to put everything I have into this job and I'll have time to do the catch up with life afterward. And as a result, I had not caught up with friends. I had not kept up with even family members at times. And when I was with my parents or my wife or, you know, my sister, I was distracted often. You know, I was going through my inbox, trying to clear out messages, keeping up with the news that was relevant to my work. And that just led to this real profound sense of isolation and loneliness when I came out. And so I struggled with that for quite a bit of time. And in the process, one of the things that I was digging into was recognizing that experience of loneliness that I was having, that it wasn't unique to me. I was like reflecting more and more on conversations I'd had even when I was in office. The social connection that I was missing and that I found was missing for so many others was not just a good feeling. It was actually something that was really vital to our physical health and our mental health. And it's why, well, ultimately when I wrote about loneliness, it was about that profound health impact around the recognition that when we struggle with being disconnected from one another, that actually has an impact on our mortality. And the mortality impact actually of loneliness and isolation are similar to the mortality impact we see with smoking, and even greater than that which we see with obesity. So this is a real issue, but it's also one that's deeply felt. And I certainly felt it a lot during that time. So coming back the second time to serve felt very different than the first time, in part because the country and the world was in a very different place with COVID, but also because I realized I really wanted to focus in on this deeper mental health crisis that was running under the surface and that was impacting so much of our lives, and that was particularly impacting kids with rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide that were all going in the wrong direction. And so that has been really where I have focused much of my time these last 3 years, is on addressing loneliness, understanding the deeper roots of this mental health crisis, and thinking about it honestly in a very personal context, not just in terms of me, but in terms of my own kids. You know, my kids are now 6 and 7, and I want them to grow up in a world where they feel happy, where they feel connected to other people, where they feel connected to other cultures. And I want them to know that, you know, if they mess up or do something wrong, that there are people who will forgive them and who will lift them up. And I want to know that they will do that for other people as well. But that means creating a world that's more kind and compassionate, more forgiving and understanding, more connected and invested in one another. But that's ultimately, I think, the work that I feel is really essential for us to do now.
Would you also add trust to that? If you have trust, then you trust that there will be that support system, or that people are not there to do you harm, and that you then might accept, you know, more.
Yes, that is the right word, trust.
Yeah.
And the thing is, trust can't be manufactured, and it also doesn't come about overnight. It comes through relationship, right? It's like when we get to know people and understand them, then we come to trust them. And when we trust people, we can also tolerate disagreement because we recognize that we're more than our opinion on a single issue, right? That there's something deeper that binds us together, some common hopes and dreams or shared humanity. But when that gets lost, when we can't see each other as human beings, but we only see each other as posts that we write on social media or as positions on a particular controversial issue, then it becomes very hard to build trust. It becomes hard then to move together in the face of adversity. And that's why a key part of not just preparing for better health, but also preparing for the next pandemic has to involve rebuilding our ties with one another and the trust that we have in society.
One of my favorite stories is of they were looking into a happy community and happiness factors, and it was this town in Denmark, and they interviewed people about why they were happy, and it was to do with trust. And they told the story about a Danish woman who had, which I remember, had taken her baby to New York, and she went inside to Balthazar, one of the, you know, cafes there, and left the baby outside in a pram. And she went in to eat, because that's what she would do in her town in Denmark. You know, she thought that actually that's what they would do. They would leave the baby outside, you know, but she was able to watch it. And she was arrested for, you know, being whatever you call it, irresponsible towards an infant, because she'd left a baby outside, you know. But that was to do with trust. And I think that what you're doing is so, you know, so inspiring and so important, and you are actually in a position to make change. People were saying in the River Cafe, thank you. So as an American, I would add myself to those thanks. And to ask you, as our last question, if food is something that helps loneliness. If food is the way you cook for your own children and the experience of taking them places, food is also comfort. Mm. So what would be your comfort food, Surgeon General?
My comfort food, well, there is a, it's something my mother makes, and it's a particular dish. It's almost like a spicy broth water that's called rasam, R-A-S-A-M. And traditionally, you would mix it with rice to eat it, and it's beautiful, spicy, flavorful. It has curry leaves in it, has pepper, has all kinds of spices and very ripe tomatoes. But you can also pour it in a cup and drink it. And when I do that, I feel like it's almost like an elixir that I'm having. It sort of fills me with warmth, literally, but also with these beautiful memories I have of my mother. You know, I had a professor once who said to me, he said, food is not the calories you put in your body. Food is the love your mother gave you as a child. And I have thought about that so often because that's what, to me, makes comfort food comfort food. It's the food that reminds me of love.
Thank you.
Thank you so much,
Beautiful.
Ruthie.
We'll see you again very soon.
I hope so. Well, I've loved this.
Come back. Thank you for listening to Ruthie's Table 4 in partnership with Montclair.
Ruthie's Table 4 is produced by Atomai Studios for iHeartRadio. It's hosted by Ruthie Rogers and it's produced by Willa Malensky. This episode was edited by Julia Johnson and mixed by Nigel Appleton. Our executive producers are Faye Stewart and Zad Rogers. Our production manager is Caitlin Paramore and our production coordinator is Bella Cellini. Thank you to everyone at the River Cafe for your help in making this episode.
This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We're the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.